a Fuelled by Coffee production.
Hello, my name is Ben Barrell, and welcome back to Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording record by record. Thank you for joining us for episode 2 of this season, and thank you to everyone that has bought me a coffee over the last couple of weeks. Hello, Ben Dobson. Hello, Eric. Hello, Stuart Cook. Hello to Pear. Hello to Maria, who's bought 6 coffees. High roller. Thank you for that. You do keep the podcast going, essentially. It costs about $20 a month to host the podcast, so you are really actually just paying for that. If you want to tip the show, if you've been enjoying it, then please do. You can find the Buy Me a Coffee link in the episode description, as per usual. Keep listening to the end of this episode to find out where we're going next. But right now, we're looking at an interesting record. Maybe not just because what's on tape, but because of what was around it at the same time. This is 1974's Planet Waves.
I've just reached a place where the willow don't bend. There's not much more to be said. It's the top of the end I'm going. I'm going.
In some ways, Planet Waves should have been a huge album for Dylan. It was his first number one, his first on a new label, and it features a reunion with the band. It also has one of his most enduring songs in the form of Forever Young. But it's often left in the dust by the seismic albums that would follow. As we'll see, it was a case of the stars almost aligning. Dylan on a fresh record label back with his famous backing band should have resulted in an album like Blood on the Tracks, but it didn't. His reunion with Columbia, some art classes and his marriage would eventually be the catalyst for that album's creative rebirth. Here though, with this record, it's more of an underrated gem rather than a classic. Although, having said that, it's not a hidden classic. This is not an Oh Mercy for me. While enjoyable, it often fails to hit the high notes that Dylan finds on a lot of his releases. It's a big pop LP full of melodies. There's also a wealth of upbeat roots rock and some swooning ballads for balance. No wonder it went to number one. Dylan has never sounded so commercial. It starts, as it means to go on, with the album opener On a Night Like This. It might sound obvious to say, but it's exactly how you'd imagine Dylan and the band to sound on a record. They launch into a country rock tune with a live sound and some neat little guitar lines, putting a slap bang in the middle of 1974.
On a night like this, I'm so glad you came around. Hold on to me so tight and heat up some coffee ground.
I love the accordion, which holds court in the right ear for most of a song. Gareth Hudson delivers that, and it's effortless. He blends this often quite alien sound into the song wonderfully. Bob's melody is endlessly catchy too, and his voice sounds great as well. It retains the smallest of rasps left over from the Nashville Skyline album, and it also reprises the New Morning delivery, but accompanies it with a more mature replica of his 60s voice. On the song, he pulls out a couple of crowd-pleasing moves, like the track stopping, for example, as he delivers the titular line, and some almost cheeky guitar lines. There's also some very accessible lyrics. He sings, "Run your fingers down my spine, bring me a touch of bliss," which is one of the many moments that appears to refer to sex. See the "put your body next to mine" line and the section about a log fire burn, burn, burning for more evidence. That last line is also a reference to Jack Kerouac's On the Road, a famous Dylan influence. Bob even sounds pretty upbeat on the song, happy even, which makes this record stand out compared to its successor, Blood on the Tracks, and even the LP before it, New Morning, forgetting Dylan and the Pat Garrett soundtrack. I'm not saying it's a laugh a minute, but this album feels like it is more of a band jamming rather than Dylan in full singer-songwriter mode. Intriguingly though, this wasn't billed as Dylan and the band, unlike the forthcoming Basement Tapes. That band sound is enhanced by the record's recording process. It will not surprise you to learn that Dylan and the band cut the record live, a common occurrence with Bob's work. Engineer slash producer Rob Fraboni talks about capturing the songs for Planet Waves. He says, "Robbie, Robertson from the band, came in the first morning and said to me, 'There's going to be no overdubs. We're doing it live. That's it. That's what's happening. And here it is.'" Bob doesn't record vocal overdubs. The record was really a performance as far as I'm concerned. It wasn't like we are making the record. It was more of a performance, and Bob wanted it to sound right, to come across. When he starts playing, there's nothing else happening but that, as far as I'm concerned. I don't think I've seen anyone else perform with such conviction. He goes on to say that despite being billed as the record's producer from many sources, it was actually a collaborative effort. He says, there was no producer on the record. Everyone was the producer. Robbie is the one who gives a lot of direction, although they all have something to say about the music and are all really involved. It would appear the band had grown a lot since the Hawks days, where they were simply Dylan's backing band. Here, they are collaborators. Although, again, interestingly, despite having a multitude of singers in their ranks, Bob is the only vocalist on the LP. This is very much a Bob Dylan album. The origins of the reunion belong to the summer of 1973. The band had played the colossal Summer Jam Festival at Watkins Glen. It was their first big outing in a year and a half. Lead guitarist Robbie Robertson is quoted as saying, "We didn't want to play Watkins Glen at all. We were in a mood. We thought, like with tours, those things, it's only money. That's the only reason you do it. But we were talked into it. You know, the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers, they're really terrific people, and it was just one of those, oh, come on, it's just up the road, you don't have to put yourself out sort of thing." He said the crowd was so responsive and into it, it was like a new experience. Robertson would relocate to Malibu in California, not too far from where Dylan lived and still has a place today. He says when he went out there, he and Dylan picked up talks and they became more advanced and quickly became enthusiastic. Later, he said the idea of touring with Bob seemed to really make sense. It was a good idea, a kind of step into the past. The other guys from the band came out to Malibu and we went straight to work. Bob hadn't been on the road since 1966, when the band had accompanied him as the Hawks. He had still played with them on a number of occasions, most recently at a New Year's concert, and when Dylan joined them for a test run at Robertson's home in September 73, everyone agreed the collaboration still cut the mustard. "We sat down and played for hours and ran over an incredible number of tunes," recalls Robertson. "Bob would ask us to play certain tunes of ours, and then we'd do the same for him, and then we'd think of something else we could do." This led to the idea of some recording sessions. Recording was quickly scheduled for November. In the run-up around October time, Dylan was in New York writing. Going into the sessions, he'd already had three songs, Forever Young, Nothing Except You, and Never Say Goodbye, which he demoed back in June. When he returned to Malibu after 20 days in New York, he had six more. Recording began on Friday the 2nd of November at the Village Recorder Studio A in Los Angeles. The only surviving song from that session on the record is Never Say Goodbye. Because my dream. This is also the first song Bob wrote after the Billy the Kid soundtrack, his previous album. I'm not counting Dylan, as it was more of a collection than a proper album. It's a nice song, and it's nice to hear a change after the first verse as we shift from the key of D to the key of G, which is fairly unusual for a Dylan tune. I enjoy the very 70s lead guitar from Robertson, which is swimming in that 70s classic rock sound with its reverb and almost rotary organ tones. But sadly, it doesn't get much better than those components. The band feel like they're on autopilot a little. Robertson does his best with some fills, but like the rest of the instrumentation, it's just nice. And that's it. It's not particularly thrilling. The same goes for Dylan's melody, which is good. It's once again very poppy. But we aim for a big grandstanding hook that doesn't quite soar in the way it should. The lyrics are stuck in the middle lane too. After some exciting scene setting with the opener of "Twilight on the frozen lake, north wind about to break, on footprints in the snow, silence down below." We then have a cul-de-sac verse of "You're beautiful beyond words, you're beautiful to me, you can make me cry, never say goodbye." With that underwhelming hook happening on the titular lines. "You're Beautiful Beyond Words" just has a whiff of sixth form poetry about it. For non-UK listeners, sixth form is the bit between school and university. It's almost a cop-out. It's just a bit lazy. It feels like a bit of a cliche. And as a Dylan fan, hearing him sing Beyond Words leaves us a little cold. We look to him to put stuff into words for us. And here, he can't. Obviously, that's what he's trying to say, but once again, it just feels a little bit cliched. Most of a song, for me, sounds like an ode to a landscape or a place. We hear of roses hanging down, of waves crashing on the shore, of iron and steel, and not to mention the frozen lake from the first verse. The final verse suggests the song concerns a lover. Bob sings, "Oh, baby, baby, baby blue, you'll change your last name too. You turned your hair to brown, love to see it hanging down." The name line there hints at marriage, but Baby Blue and the hair turning brown lyrics are also in keeping with the naturalistic theme of the previous verses. Blue's obvious connotations for water and brown's for leaves and the autumn has a nice synergy about them. It could also even hint that the song is just a love letter to a special place for Dylan. It does, at times, feel like we are hearing from someone looking back at a changing landscape in awe. That allusion to steel and iron in his dreams could even put us in Dylan's hometown Duluth, which has close ties to the steel industry. That well-placed key change is interesting as well. We shift from a cold, frozen landscape to something a little more in bloom, which adds to the nostalgia. It's like our narrator is in this colder landscape dreaming of home, and then we enter the nostalgia as the key change hits. It almost signifies us going from present day back to the narrator's history. There's also an argument to say this concerns Dylan's love for ironworks. Fans will know he enjoys making iron gates, some of which I've seen up close and are really impressive. Perhaps this song is the beginning of that. Dylan is quoted on his ironwork saying, "Gates appeal to me because of the negative space they allow." Going on to say, "They can be closed, but at the same time they allow seasons and breezes to enter and flow. They can shut you out or they can shut you in, and in some ways, there's no difference." Either way, this song represents what we are seeing throughout the album. Like New Morning, at times it feels a little domesticated. You never feel like big issues are being mulled over, which is both a positive and a negative on the record. Sometimes you miss the gravitas of it all, but at the same time, it's nice to hear Dylan talking about different themes for once. Whilst there is a mention of love on this record a lot, and happy love at that, sometimes it does get a little darker. On album closer Wedding Song, for example, its opening lines are, "I love you more than ever, more than time and more than love. I love you more than money and more than the stars above." Later, the lyrics sound like a precursor to Dylan's religious period that he began at the end of the decade. We hear lines like, "You breathed on me and made my life a richer one to live. When I was deep in poverty, you taught me how to give." Which kind of reads like a Bible verse. We're back to domesticated love on the next verse with, "You gave me babies 1, 2, 3. What is more, you saved my life." But then this is followed with more biblical overtones as Dylan sings, "Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Your love cuts like a knife. My thoughts of you don't ever rest. They'd kill me if I lie. I'd sacrifice the world for you and watch my senses die." With the final verse, we find ourselves going back to nature with the words, "You turn the tide on me each day and teach my eyes to see. Just being next to you is a natural thing for me. And I could never let you go, no matter what goes on, because I love you more than ever now. The past is gone." Clearly, this love has been through some obstacles. There's a sadness here, but it does appear to prevail. While we know Dylan was penning tunes about his marriage in danger on Desire, released in 1976, and while he disputes it, we can assume that at least there were some traces of his marriage's downfall on Blood on the Tracks a year before, this song could even predate that as a biographical tune about Sarah, his famous wife. It's not a breakup song, but it does feel personal, which is another trait of the album, actually, brought on by those lines of domesticated love that we keep hearing about. The song Sonics are the most stripped back the album gets. It's without the band, but it's in keeping with a lot of the album in that it's good rather than great. It never ascends to the top tier. There's nothing wrong with it. The melody is simple yet interesting, but ultimately, once again, it's never enthralling. Also, it doesn't really evolve into anything. The chord structure is pretty much the same throughout. We have A minor going to C and then to D. He does mix it up a little bit on the third line of most verses with F, A minor, C slash G and D minor, with the G popping up every now and then. But for the most part, it's pretty similar all the way through. In the song, Dylan returns to his early days. He sings and simultaneously plays guitar and harmonica.
I love you more than ever, more than time and more than love. I love you more than money and more than the stars above.
This was the last song written for the album, and it was recorded in what was meant to be the album's last session on November the 9th. Fraboni remembers Bob saying around noon that he had a new song that he wanted to try later, but it wasn't quite ready yet. Later, he apparently walked up to him and said, "I'm ready." Fraboni then said he went in and asked if we were rolling, and that was it. That was the take you hear on the record. Done. You can actually hear the buttons of his jacket knocking on the guitar if you listen carefully. Frivone gives us an insight to the album's sessions. He says, the band were really something. Bob would just run the songs down and they'd play it once. They'd come into the control room and listen, and that's the other thing that really astounded me, actually. No one was saying anything. No one was saying, you ought to be doing this or you ought to be doing that. They just all came in and listened and they knew what they had to do. And that would be it. Usually one take or the following. That's pretty much how the whole album went. As we've seen a lot from Dylan, the studio time was rapid. There were six sessions from the 2nd to the 14th, and by all accounts, they were relaxed and informal. So informal, in fact, that on the first day's session, drummer Leven Helm was not even present. Nevertheless, the session was devoted to all three songs demoed in June. Dylan and the band succeeded in recording complete takes of Forever Young and Nobody Except You, as well as the aforementioned master take of Never Say Goodbye. In the next session on the 5th, Helm was present, and they made another attempt at Nobody Except You, resulting in a satisfactory take marked for possible inclusion. It would never make it, though. The song itself would end up on the first bootleg collection, and once again, it seems to concern Bob's youth. We hear him sing about hymns that he used to hear and how he used to play in the cemetery. The day did capture master takes of tracks that were included on the record, namely You Angel You and Going, Going, Gone. The former of which is not the best. Dylan even dismissed it in an interview in 1985, calling the song's words dummy lyrics. And I can see what he means. The opening verse is just a bit pedestrian. He sings, you angel you, your essence got me under your wing. The way you walk, the way you talk, I feel I could almost sing. By the time we get to the chorus, though, things do lighten up. In fact, I like the melody, and Dylan's performance is pretty good. But like we've already seen on the record, it just never really takes your breath away. What you talk with your memory of my mind. And oh, I can't sleep at night for trying. Yes, I never did feel this way before. Never did. Things get much darker on the track Going, Going, Gone. This is a song about endings. I'm going, going, gone, he sings on the chorus, echoing the famous auction house phrase. We're then treated to some nice lines about finding happiness before you regret it, before life passes you by. I've been hanging on the threads, I've been playing it straight, now I've just got to cut loose before it gets too late, he sings. And later we hear, Grandma said, boy, go and follow your heart, and you'll be fine at the end of the line. All that's gold isn't meant to shine, don't you and your one true love ever part. With this, the song creeps into a story with a moral territory. It's kind of saying, follow your heart and you can't go wrong. Life is for living, for love, not just for riches or fame, etc. This once again echoes the domestic undercurrent on the record, which, as we know, was also present in Dylan's home life at this point too, something we'll touch on later. Interestingly, there's also a musical shift on the bridge too. We go from the chords of F, A minor and D minor on the verses to a constant G chord, a more bolder sound, which feels like those lines about following your heart are from somewhere else, a different time. Our narrator is looking back at good advice from his grandma, and now finally, after all these years, he's heeding it. We come back to the present in the final verse as we revert back to the original chord structure. The final lines are, I've been walking the road, I've been living on the edge. Now I've just got to go before I get to the ledge. So I'm going, I'm just going, I'm gone. Many times people have connected these lines to suicide as we hear our narrator getting close to the ledge, which I can more than see. It offers an interesting conclusion to our narrator's story. He's been trying to change his life and take that advice, but it's no use now, so he's ending it all. However, for me, and a first in my usual gloomy outlook, I feel here it's our narrator jumping into a new life. It sounds to my ear like our narrator wants to keep going, but just not like this. He's killing off his old existence, moving on to a new one. Those lines about cutting loose before it's too late and the highlighting of grandma's advice, not to mention the lines in the final verse, now I've just got to go before I get to the ledge. For me, it sounds like he's suggesting if he doesn't take that metaphorical leap and change his life, then he'll end up on that ledge, but he's not there just yet. Musically, it's a song that I really like. It's one of my favourite sounding tunes on the entire record, but in true Planet Wave style, I'm not really bowled over by it. It's 70s rock, once again courtesy of Robertson's lead guitar, with some slide guitar thrown in for good measure, really becomes an enjoyable listen. Hudson's organ and the piano, which comes from Richard Manuel, gives the whole thing a wonderful atmosphere, grounded nicely by Rick Danko on bass and Helm's conservative, in a good way, drumming. On the same day this song is captured, they also attempted to get Forever Young onto tape, but the results were not to Dylan's satisfaction. He returned to it for three more sessions. It would prove to be the LP's most difficult song to record. On the next day, November the 6th, Dylan and the band recorded master takes for three more songs, Hazel, Something There Is About You, and Tough Mama, the latter of which finds us once again in classic rock territory. I like the melody, which is given some nice detail with the lyrics that are familiar Planet Waves territory. There's the countryside, there's flowers and the domestic. We hear about sisters and puppers. We also hear about travelling. There's lyrics about lonesome roads. And we finish with our narrator asking his love to meet him at the border. Our narrator feels like he is trying to escape to or with his love. Each verse appears to be addressed to her, the tough mama, the dark beauty, the sweet goddess, or the silver angel, as they're described in each verse. However, in the last verse, we hear, I'm crestfallen. The world of illusion is at my door. Our narrator is trapped, mentally stuck somewhere, and it's his love that can help him get away. And once again, we hear about wanting to change a life, change a way of living. I ain't hauling any of my lambs to the marketplace anymore, Bob sings, before we finally hear, I've gained some recognition, but I've lost my appetite. This could easily be a story that Bob has concocted out of nothing, but I also feel it might just be autobiographical. By this point, to put it bluntly and read the lyrics at face value, he had gained recognition and probably had lost his appetite for work, for his music. That line easily mirrors this part of his career. By the end of the decade, of course, he would change his life. He would find Jesus, which, as we discussed in that episode of this podcast, comes as a result in part of his fame, his recognition, if you will. His motorcycle crash also helped to facilitate this too. We know his life was a little more domesticated after that famous crash. He even says in his memoirs, Chronicles Volume 1, I was fantasizing about a 9-to-5 existence, a house on a tree-lined block with a white picket fence and pink roses in the backyard. Going on to say that by the 80s, I, quote, got to do things that I loved the best. Little League games, birthday parties, taking my kids to school, camping trips, boating, rafting, canoeing, fishing. I was living on record royalties. This album's undercurrent of escape and domestication might just detail all of that. Furthermore, Ellen Willis of The New Yorker called the record one of Dylan's most personal, which I struggle to disagree with. This all feels like Dylan, who is no longer the biggest songwriter in the world, the man who's taken a step back, whose career isn't all conquering as it once was in the previous decade, is putting that into his lyrics. It's no surprise then that Dylan's hometown of Duluth gets a shout out in Something There Is About You. We hear it on the second verse when he sings, thought I'd shaken the wonder and the phantoms of my youth. Rainy days on Great Lakes walking the hills of old Duluth. There was me and Danny Lopez, cold eyes, black night. And then there was Ruth. Something There Is About You that brings back the long forgotten truth. We then yet again hear about landscapes laced with nostalgia, but there seems to be a sad story at the roots of it all. Those cold eyes and phantoms put us in the territory of bad memories, but once again, there's also love as well. It would appear he's been saved from those memories. Dylan sings, suddenly I found you and the spirit in me sings. Don't have to look no further, you're the soul of many things. And later, I was in a whirlwind, now I'm in a better place.
Something there is about you that moves with style and grace. I was in a whirlwind, now I'm in some better place. My hand's on the saber, and you picked up on every time.
The only thing that's a little bit jarring about this song for me is the clunkiness of the titular lines. Something There Is About You just doesn't quite roll off the tongue as it should. The preceding track on the album isn't a million miles away from all of this. Hazel is once again a rock song leaning towards soft rock. It's in ballad territory with a nod to country. It begins with a little bit of a cliche. The opening line mentions dirty blonde hair, which sounds so much like a line from a rock ballad that it's the sort of thing you'd expect to hear on a fictional song from a film about 70s rock. The clichés don't stop there, though. There's that reoccurring line of, "Ooh, a touch of your love," which feels uninspired and is the sort of thing that's sung when you're working out a song's melody in the studio, like a stand-in line to fill the space before you fill it with proper lyrics. The song came easy enough in the studio, though. 7 of the 8 takes were complete songs, which is not always the case with Bob. But that might just be the problem. This doesn't feel like a passion project. It just feels like a song to fill the track listing. Remember, there was a limited time in the studio with everyone together. This wasn't cut over 6 months. It was just cut in 6 days. They needed songs and they needed them quickly. As we've seen with Bob's little trip to New York before the sessions, he was writing for the record. He wasn't just collecting songs together. He was actively writing for it. After this tune, we are back in the studio on the 8th of November and the album's opening track is cut, as is its centrepiece, Forever Young. A demo version of the song was recorded in New York City in June 1973, the one found on Biograph. While that was the first time it found its way onto tape, it's actually even older than that. Dylan spent a lot of time in Arizona in 1972, living there apparently. There's not really too many details about it, but Forever Young comes from this time. Dylan is quoted apparently telling a friend, saying, "I've been tinkering around with a new song. I wrote it for Jesse. It kind of goes like this." Jesse is, of course, Bob's eldest son. Bob goes on to say, "I wrote it thinking about my boys and not wanting to be too sentimental. The lines just came to me. They were done in a minute."
May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you.
Despite what Dylan says, this is a sentimental song. It does stray into the realms of cheesy Bob, which is not a criticism. Regular podcast listeners will know this is my favourite Dylan subgenre. I cannot get enough of it. And while it is about Jesse reaffirming the album's theme of domesticity, it also is apparently a dig at Neil Young too. Young's song Heart of Gold was a huge tune in 1972. Dylan told journalist Scott Cohen in November 1985, "It bothered me every time I listened to Heart of Gold. You know, I needed to lay back for a while, forget things, myself included, and I'd get so far away and then turn on the radio, and there I am, but it's not me." The "there I am, but it's not me" quote suggests he was sick of being imitated by everyone. The last thing you want to do when you're trying to figure out what to do next, trying to move on from a busy, fraught past, is being reminded of yourself on the radio. Except it's not you. It's you, but not you. I love Neil Young, and he's an incredible artist with a body of work that any songwriter would love to own, but it's fair to say there is a whole heap of Dylan in his work. He even said himself, "I'm a B student of Bob Dylan." This, combined with every label looking for a new Dylan, clearly made Bob react by cutting a very Dylan song. Except it's not really. It's not a Dylan tune like Blowing in the Wind. It's how Dylan sounds via his impersonators. We could even go so far as to say the title is a pun. May you stay forever young. A sarcastic jibe at Neil creating his own sound, or not. Although I have my doubts as to whether this pun was deliberate or not. I suspect it wasn't. For me, it's just a little bit too glib. But Forever Young does sound like a Dylan song covered by someone else, someone more commercially minded. Almost a Dylan tune that someone else has covered and then Dylan has recovered. Unlike a lot of his ballads, it has a commercial sentimentality about it. The lyrics for a start, in a very un-Dylan way, are direct. A father hopes his child will stay happy and strong as the future brings inevitable trials, etc. Also, in another nod to it being more commercial, the chorus is huge. We used to, as Dylan fans, beautiful songs that are fragile and sepia-toned vignettes like Simple Twist of Fate or the mournful candlelight type of song like Spanish Boots of Leather. But here, by the time we reach the chorus, there's no mistake. This is a stadium-sized anthem. It's that reprise of Forever Young over a rush of drum fills after the verse. It's what separates this song from those previous compositions. It takes off into a commercial pop song in the same bracket as All By Myself or Can't Fight This Feeling.
Forever young. Oh,
No wonder this song was covered by the likes of Rod Stewart and even the UK X Factor winner Louisa Johnson. On paper, Dylan is the last artist to write an X Factor winner's song. This shows you how unique it is in his back catalogue. Clearly with this, it's treading a line of being overly sentimental. Some have dismissed it because of this, but for me, it works, and it works really well. I'm not alone, actually. Fraboni says, "We only did one take of the slow version of Forever Young. The take was so riveting, it was so powerful, so immense, that when everyone came in, nobody really said anything. And it's with this take the album finally gets its magic, some stardust. It's been an enjoyable affair up to this point, but finally some spine tingling is going on, and it's much needed." However, when Martha, a girlfriend of Dylan's childhood pal, Lou Kemp, attended an album session and heard the recording of the song, she was not impressed at all. Fraboni says, "Lou Kemp and this girl came by and she made a crack at him. She said, 'Come on, Bob, you're getting mushy in your old age,' when she heard Forever Young. It was based on that comment that Dylan decided to leave the slow version off the record." It's a bold move to question Dylan in the studio. It's actually strangely impressive. It's sort of like striding up to Salvador Dali and saying, "I don't think the melted clocks are really working. Do you?" Interestingly, though, it appears to affect Dylan. While it wasn't left off the record, he was convinced almost by the entire recording team to keep it on there. He has to put his mind at rest by including a less sentimental, less upbeat, and of course less magical version straight after it. As one side ends with the slow version, another starts with the faster cut.
May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others.
This has been done a number of times on a number of records. Arcade Fire's Everything Now, with the song or songs Infinite Content being the most recent example I can think of. With that record, though, there was a point to it. However, on here, this is a symptom of Planet Wave's lack of confidence. A 66 Dylan might have told Martha to leave and keep her opinions to herself, but at this point of his career, after a rocky part of it, he might not have been in the right headspace he once was when it came to his work. And this is an issue elsewhere too. Self-Portrait and other recordings from this period led to a souring of feelings between Dylan and his only record label to date, Columbia. His contract expired with Bob feeling like he wasn't being treated well, feeling like they'd lost interest. He signed with David Geffen's Asylum label. Clearly the thought was to get Dylan back on track commercially. Geffen was good at shifting units, and the label was home to some big hitters. And it sort of works to a degree here. I mean, the sales for this album are decent, good even, and as we know, it went to number one, but it wouldn't quite be a home run. Geffen is quoted as saying, "Three Asylum albums were released in January. Carly Simon's Hot Cakes, which sold just over 1 million. Joni Mitchell's Caught and Spark, which sold 1.4 million. The latter of which featured Robbie Robertson on electric guitar. And Planet Waves, which shipped 771,000. Geffen goes on to say, "We've taken back less than 15%, which is standard for the industry. So around 110,000. So he ends up selling around 600,000 probably, which is fantastic for Bob. His influence and importance have always been greater than his sales, and it's naive to think otherwise." It would appear Bob thought they were going to ship more. It's understandable that he'd want a huge hit on a new label, and this was a good-sized hit for him, but nothing out of the ordinary. Columbia Records, meanwhile, simultaneously released Dylan, a collection of studio outtakes, a bitter response to Bob signing with a rival record label. But of course, he'll be back. Dylan and Geffen's personalities apparently clashed, and according to Fred Goodman's Mansion on the Hill, Dylan thought Geffen was just interested in being a celebrity. After a successful 1974 tour, Dylan couldn't work out why millions wanted to see him live, but not as many people bought the record. And with that, he thought Geffen failed him. It's up for debate whether he did or not. This is a commercial record from Dylan, but even at his height, Bob has never been a top level seller. He was back with Columbia just after a year, signing a record that reportedly paid him 60 cents a record more than Asylum and gave him a new improved royalty on his back catalogue, a key part of the deal. He would channel this momentum into the classic Blood on the Tracks, his first release on that deal. But that's all in the future. Here, Dylan is still lacking in confidence and putting both Forever Youngs on the final track listing. Martha is still in his head, even on the album's next track, Dirge, originally titled Dirge for Martha. Well, that's what it's labelled on the studio's tape box anyway. Either this is a song aimed at her after her studio comments, the tune does have an acidic tone akin to Positively 4th Street, or more as I suspect, the title is just a joke at her forever young dig. As in, you think that's bad? Well, get a load of this. Dirge, after all, is slang, in the UK at least, for a song or piece of music that is considered too slow or miserable or boring, exactly what she was describing. Also, the fact that it comes straight after the Forever Youngs adds to this, as does the fact it was written during the sessions too. Given that we do end up with two Forever Youngs on the track listing, that comment from Martha was clearly in his mind, so we shouldn't be too surprised that he might want to write a song about her too. But the song's title also fits the word Dirge's other meaning. It's a mournful song as well. In the song, the curtains falling that's mentioned is a well-worn metaphor for death. We also hear about Suicide Road, martyrs and angels as well. But I don't feel like Dylan is singing about someone specific. The title's double meaning keeps bringing me back to Dylan wrestling with his past. As we've seen, there was a hint he was forcing a comeback with this new label and ambition for record sales, and here he is hating someone who he has spent a lot of time and love on. Could he be lamenting fame, going back to that white picket fence line from Chronicles, or even his longtime manager Albert Grossman, or even New York, or even the New York folk scene? Who knows? New York is referenced in the song in the form of Lower Broadway, and we hear a line about songs of freedom, which points to early Dylan and fits in with Martha's old comment. Either way, like we've seen countless times on the record, Dylan is reaching back. He's facing up to things and people from his past brought on by his career crossroads. It feels like our narrator has almost been broken and is now looking back. Like this is a final therapy session, a final spit of bile before he can put it all to rest.
There are those who worship loneliness. I'm not one of them. In this age of fiberglass, I'm searching for a gem. The crystal ball upon the wall hasn't shown me nothing yet. I've paid the price of solitude, but at least
the lyrics are incredible. Dylan sings, "There are those who worship loneliness, I'm not one of them. In this age of fiberglass, I'm searching for a gem. The crystal ball upon the wall hasn't shown me nothing yet. I've paid the price of solitude, but at least I'm out of debt." I love that witty line at the end. By the song's conclusion, as I mentioned, it appears we get some peace, some closure. There's a sober conclusion. He sings, "So sing your praise of progress and of the doom machine. The naked truth is still taboo whenever it can be seen. Lady Luck, who shines on me, will tell you where I'm at. I hate myself for loving you, but I should get over that." It's a stunning conclusion and delivered so well by Dylan. It's so finite, so devastating almost, but not for our narrator, for his subject. He's faced up to his former love, his former existence, and now it's time for him to move on. And move on is exactly what he does. Like with Most of the Time from Oh Mercy or Buckets of Rain from Blood on the Tracks, this should be the song you listen to after a breakup. It should be prescribed on the NHS. This is like a self-help class rolled up into music, full of poetic advice. This is Wise Dylan in full flow. As a poem for me, this is top drawer. I love it. It reads so well. It's so witty and poignant and angry and poetic, sometimes all at once. But, and I know I'm in the minority here, for me, the music lets it down a little. Personally speaking, it starts with the doom machine line. It reminds me of a lyric from Desolation Row where Bob sings about the heart attack machine. They also share similar licks on their respective lead guitars. Robertson plays the one here. Whilst Mike Bloomfield is on duties for the Highway 61 cuts.
Yes, I know them, they're quite lame. I had to rearrange their faces.
This comparison and familiarity reminds me that Dirge doesn't do what Desolation Row does sonically. Of course, that song is a classic. We can't compare all tunes to that. But Dirge, unfortunately, shares a wheelhouse with some classic songs like Desolation Row and Blind Willie McTell and Positively 4th Street. And compared to those, this is significantly lower in quality when it comes to the sonics. The piano playing has been lauded by many, but for me, it just sounds like Dylan is playing it with a hammer. It's also impressive that Robertson recorded the licks on the guitar in one take with no overdubs, but again, just like we've seen elsewhere, the performance lacks a little bit of magic for me. I know many will disagree. The general consensus is this is a well-loved song, but for me, it's good rather than great. And that track kind of sums up the whole LP. It's a good record that never strays into magic territory. This LP is an enjoyable way to spend your time. It's fun, it's captivating, it's full of likability, but it's never a passionate affair. Practically, it did a good job for Bob. It put him back on top commercially. It would ironically strengthen old ties with his record label. And whether you like it or not, Martha, Forever Young has become an important track in Dylan's back catalogue for a whole host of reasons. It also created a road on which he travelled to a career high with Blood on the Tracks. I'm not sure we get that masterpiece in the same way we do without Planet Waves. And for that alone, we should truly thank Lady Luck for shining on us.
Lady Luck, who shines on
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it or you didn't enjoy it, maybe you've got a bone to pick with me. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bob Dylan Podcast. I'm there too on Twitter at Ben Burrell and Instagram at Benjamin Burrell. If you really enjoyed it, then you can, as I mentioned at the start, you can tip the show, buy me a coffee. The link is in the episode description. Next week, we are looking at, well, there's no other way to put it, a terrible record. Under the Red Sky is where we go next. And while it is a terrible record, in my opinion, there's a couple of bits about it and about the process of it that I like, which we'll get to in next week's episode. I kind of like looking at the bad albums as much, if not more, than the good albums and working out where it all went wrong. So join us next week for that. In the meantime, thank you for listening and goodbye.
A Fueled by Coffee production.